Thank you for listening to the Damage Report podcast, the show covering the true threats facing our country and what you can actually do about them. You can support this free podcast by leaving us a review and giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to be listening to it. Every review helps more people discover the show at no cost to you. Welcome back to another episode of the Damage Report. I am John Adarola. Thank you for joining us once again for what is going to be an absolutely gigantic show. We've got a couple of huge pieces of news that we're going to break down. We're also going to be joined by a pair of candidates. We are in, of course, the very last days. I think at some point we're going to have the little counter. We have only days to go until this midterm election. There are so many candidates that you need to know about. We're going to be profiling more and more of them throughout this week. On today's show, we have George Hanna, who's running in Kansas's House District 47, so at the state legislature. And in Kansas, where Kris Kobach, of course, is the Secretary of State, we know that he is someone who can't be trusted when it comes to voter access, things like that. And in George Hanna's race, that has actually become an issue. So we're going to be breaking that down and the stakes in what is looking like a very close race. Later on in the show, Janine Lee Lake, who's running in the 6th District Congressional District in Indiana, actually running against Mike Pence's older brother. So that is going to be very fun. She looks like an awesome progressive pushing for Medicare for all those sorts of issues. So we're going to be profiling her as well. At the end of the show, we're going to be taking a tour of news from around the globe. And I don't think that I'm overhyping this by saying that one of the stories, the pieces of news that we're going to talk about in that last segment is, I think, objectively the most important news story in my lifetime, maybe. Absolutely gigantic. And it is getting just a little bit of attention on social media and on the news. So we're going to be talking about that as well. But starting off with the story of the past week, which is political violence. In the past few days, since the wave of attempted mail bombings and the shooting over the weekend of the Tree of Life Synagogue, Donald Trump has not wanted to take even one tiny shred of responsibility, either personally or as the figurehead of a party that has been stoking racial resentment and religious resentment and those sorts of things for as long as I've been alive. But it has accelerated in recent years. And he bristles at the very notion that anything he says could lead to this sort of violence. And in doing this, in attempting to defend himself, he is going to what I would classify as ridiculous lengths to both sides this issue. And last night, he did an interview on Fox News with Laura Ingraham. Very, very bold of him to go before that firing squad of a reporter after this violence. But he was talking with her. And look at how he responds to the idea that he could in any way be responsible.
I was in the headline of the Washington Post, my name associated with this crazy bomber.
Now,
Trump bomber or something. But I was in the headline when they got him. They didn't say bomber found. They talked about Trump in the headline. Now, they didn't do that with Bernie Sanders when he had. They didn't do that with the Democrats when other people came out. They didn't do that with President Obama, with the church, the horrible situation with the church. They didn't do that. They put my name in the headlines.
Okay, so there's like at least four ridiculous things fitted in that 30-second clip. Hopefully I'll remember all of them. First of all, in terms of the media being willing to link him there, he says they didn't say bomber found, they said Trump. Well, they also said bomber found. I remember reporting on the fact that we talked about finding him. But in so doing, when we find out that he is one of the most enthusiastic Trump supporters that I think we've ever seen in this country, that seems kind of relevant. I feel like you should probably mention that. As I pointed out on Twitter, if it had been the other way, if he hadn't been a Trump supporter, but we found out that back in 1979, he donated $10 to the Sierra Club, Fox News would be calling for all Democrats to disavow their party. We know how that plays out. Instead, this guy is an obvious Trump supporter, an enthusiastic believer in the variety of conspiracy theories that Donald Trump and his supporters push on a daily basis, covered his van with Trump stickers and Trump posing on tanks and attacking all of the targets of Trump's ire on a daily basis, goes to Trump rallies, is holding up signs and all that. I think the media has an obligation to point that out. I know that Trump supporters don't like that realization, the idea that one of their own could do this sort of thing, because the vast, vast, vast majority of Trump supporters would never think of hurting another person. But it is the truth, and we need to acknowledge that. And even though the media, as Trump is pointing out there, did acknowledge it, I have a question for you. We're a couple of days out from this guy being found, and we know beyond a shadow of a doubt that he was a Trump fanatic. What percentage of Trump supporters do you think accept that the bomber was a Trump fan. I'm really curious. Do you think that it's 100%? No, of course we don't think that it's 100%. Do you think half? Do you think 10%? Is it less than 10% except what is obviously true? All the evidence shows that. And so he's frustrated with the media even attempting to get across that inconvenient truth to his fans. But I don't think he needs to worry because I don't think they're going to believe it anyway. So beyond that, beyond his frustration with the media, he tries to both sides it in a number of different ways. He starts off with their go-to in this case, and that is Bernie Sanders. Now, of course, Steve Scalise was shot. He was shot by a guy that had volunteered on Bernie Sanders' campaign. Now, it's important to note at this point that literally anyone can volunteer for a political campaign. They weren't paying this guy. They didn't go out and headhunt for this guy. He wasn't a campaign chairman or something like that. He was a volunteer. But because he was a volunteer, after that shooting, Bernie Sanders came out and gave a speech saying that it was absolutely disgusting. He feels terrible. He disavows all political violence and all of that. And that message, I think, was very easy to buy because Bernie Sanders has never once called for any form of violence of the sort that Donald Trump casually talks about at every one of his rallies. He's never done that. And much more importantly, and what makes this Steve Scalise Bernie Sanders thing a ridiculous comparison to make in the light of all the political violence that we've had in this country over the past couple of weeks, is that Bernie Sanders does not talk about Steve Scalise. He does not give speeches about Steve Scalise. He doesn't do weird nicknames for him and talk about him constantly on Twitter and social media. He doesn't bring him up randomly at rallies to get applause lines. He hasn't done any of that stuff. If you were trying to put together some sort of enemies list for Bernie Sanders, Steve Scalise wouldn't make the top 200. And so it was a weird, random, and tragic form of political violence from a guy who was tangentially involved with Bernie Sanders. That is not the case with these mail bombings. These were exactly the people that Donald Trump talks about on a daily basis. He comes up with weird nicknames for them. He demonizes them on social media. He brings them up in rallies, all of the things I was just talking about. That is why there is a connection there. Whether you think that Donald Trump is responsible or not, certainly this guy was going after the people that Trump demonizes. That was not the case with Bernie Sanders and Steve Scalise. After trying to throw blame onto Bernie Sanders, he then says, this doesn't happen with other Democrats, which is not actually an example. It sounds like one, but he actually can't come up with another example of a Democrat, which is why he uses that vague language. I don't know what he's referring to, if he's referring to anything, in fact. But then he moves on to the most ridiculous one of all. Barack Obama didn't get blamed like this in the church shooting. Now, we are used to a lot of ridiculous statements by Donald Trump. Things have been normalized that I never thought would ever be normalized in this country. But that is one of the most, obviously, it's not just a stupid comment. It is a purposefully inflammatory, offensive, whatever word you want to use, thing to say about this. So a white supremacist goes into a black church and shoots up the black congregants at that church. And Donald Trump says it's not fair that the media didn't blame Barack Obama for black people being shot up by a white supremacist. So this isn't a case where he has found sort of the inverse of what's going on with him and his supporters. This is the same thing as what's going on with him and his supporters. It's white supremacists acting out against perceived enemies, whether particular politicians, members of the media, or whole communities, if they're shooting up a synagogue, if they're shooting up a bunch of African Americans. So he is saying that Barack Obama, the first black president, should have been blamed, should have gotten some of the blame for a white supremacist choosing to target black Christians. That is not just absurd, that is horrendous. And he knows that Barack Obama never did anything to lead to that sort of violence. He was constantly a figure giving high profile speeches attempting to bring together races and get rid of some of that strife. Something that, of course, is not his responsibility to do. He inherited a country at that time that had hundreds of years of horrendous racism and violence in basically one direction. And he was expected by the other side, which wins elections based on those sorts of racists, to heal all of those wounds, which is ridiculous. But in fact, President Barack Obama, after that shooting, sang Amazing Grace during the eulogy for the 9 Charleston victims at the Emmanuel AME Church. So he did everything he could afterward, even though he bore no responsibility whatsoever to make the situation better for the actual victims. Expect nothing like that from Donald Trump. So three examples there, if you can call them examples, none of them absolve him of the responsibility he has to come to grips with the sort of movement that he and others like him are leading in this country. Now, beyond Donald Trump, you also had Kellyanne Conway going out and attempting to both sides it and divert from responsibility for what's actually going on in this particular case with the synagogue shooting, as you'll see.
The anti-religiosity in this country, that it's somehow in vogue and funny to make fun of anybody of faith, to constantly be making fun of people who express religion, the late night comedians, the unfunny people on TV shows, it's always anti-religious. And remember, these people were gunned down in their place of worship,
right,
as were the people in South Carolina several years ago. Mm-hmm. And they were there because they're people of faith, and it's that faith that needs to bring us together. This is no time to be driving right. God out of the public square,
right.
No time to be making
ever.
Fun of people. That's right.
Okay, so right there you saw Kellyanne Conway doing what she is paid to do, tell vicious, vicious lies and distract us from actually solving the problems that she purports to address. So again, she brought up the shooting at that church, and she's tying it also to the synagogue shooting. I guess we're supposed to believe that Stephen Colbert is responsible for that, for mocking religion, which she was alluding to. He is, of course, very religious himself, which is ridiculous. They didn't go into that church and shoot it up because Dylann Roof really didn't like religion. Tree of Life Synagogue wasn't shot up because that guy didn't like religion. They loved religion. They loved their own religion. They just didn't like those brands of it. They liked Christianity, but Dylann Roof didn't like black Christians. And this guy sure loved, in Pittsburgh, he liked Christianity. He didn't like Jews. That's the problem. This is not a problem with anti-religiosity. This is a problem with white supremacists and anti-Semites. And so that's very easy to, we can see which groups are anti-Semites, we can see which groups are white supremacists. They don't want that. They don't want you identifying the actual virulent, violent strains of right-wing thought in this country. They want to cloud the issue with anti-religiosity. Because if you can get it to be about that, then it's not a right-wing thing at all. Hell, any secular person, any atheist could be tied in with that. But are there secular people going around committing terrible, violent acts on a daily basis? Is that the problem that we actually have in this country? Is it that atheists that are going around and just targeting random religious people, is that what America is facing right now? No, of course it's not. White supremacy, anti-Semitism, two things that are tied very closely together, and they have levels of hatred, sorts of hatred that are not being stoked by both sides. It is one side very specifically willing to tolerate and encourage that sort of thought and that sort of violence. Now, unfortunately, we do have to take our first break. When we come back,
we need to talk about a relatively new show called Unfucking the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of Unfucking the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today, and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
We're going to be pivoting to the first interview. George Hanna is a Kansas state-level legislator who's running in this midterm election. We're going to be breaking down not only the issues there in Kansas, but also some of the problems with voter suppression and false information about the election being given out after this. I'd like to welcome to the show a candidate for Kansas's House District 47 Democrat, George Hanna. Welcome to the show, George.
Thank you, John. I appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us, especially in this run-up to election. I know you've got a lot of campaigning to do, but we wanted to talk about your candidacy and also about some of the problems that have cropped up in it with Kris Kobach, the Secretary of State for Kansas. Before we get to that, though, I'm very interested in this wave to learn more about what is leading to people running for office. So if you could give us a little bit about your background leading up to this run.
Well, I don't know if you remember me, but you actually interviewed me in Philadelphia as a Bernie delegate at the Media Day walkout. And, you know, I came back from Philly. Instead of getting all upset and doing the dim exit, I took it to heart. The only way we can fix this is to get involved and change it internally. So I immediately came home, found the hardest district I could, and decided to run.
Well, I certainly like the boldness, not only of the run, but also, you know, being willing to go for one of the difficult ones. And I certainly agree with your strategy. Like, I think that the exact sort of establishment Democrats that we were opposing back then would love for candidates like you to say, you know what, I'm not even going to try to reform the party. And around the country in these primaries, we've seen some amazing candidates winning, and they're likely to go on to actually help to reshape the Democratic Party after these midterms. So thank you for being a part of that. Now, in terms of your actual race, you've had some issues with Kris Kobach. He's not a guy that is a fan of democracy. How is that influencing your race?
Well, our county clerk has sent out some conflicting directions on how to fill out the ballots, which is really kind of, it's disheartening, because on the ballot it's printed how to fill in the oval and let the machine run it through. But yet the Secretary of State had instructions that they included with the ballot that says an X or a check will work just fine. And of course, now we have no way of knowing which races were seen by the machine when you run it through.
Yeah.
So I'm looking at a possible recount, hand count, right out of the gate on the first day.
So, I mean, is it your belief is that county clerk just didn't know, like wasn't sure exactly what would qualify? Or do you think that this is you being targeted with this misinformation?
Well, there's only two counties that this happened that I'm aware of right now, and they're both very, very are. Neither one of the incumbents were endorsed by the Republicans for Common Sense here in Kansas, and they're very much Kobach strongholds. So I suspect some shenanigans there. I know the clerk here in Jefferson County as an ethical person, and I think she was just going off of the directive from Secretary of State.
Okay. And one of the reasons, of course, that this seems very significant is the indications are that your race is looking like it's likely to be pretty tight, correct?
Yeah, actually, if our polling margins stick the way they are, I'm actually up by 6% right now with all the advance ballots that have come in, or at least have been voted. And this used to be a plus 26 R district.
Wow.
So it's a huge lift for the House race. But in a congressional race in the last governor's race, it actually will vote Democrat. So they just need the right candidate. And, you know, I'm a long haired, tattooed biker Democrat. So I'm like a unicorn in Kansas. And the boldness of my candidacy has resonated very well with the unaffiliateds and the Republicans. I put a 12-foot billboard on the driveway of my opponent in April that's been there ever since. It says, vote for me.
Wow, that is bold. Okay, so I want to talk about your candidacy, because you are endorsed by Our Revolution. So talk to us about your platform. And especially, you mentioned there that these unaffiliated voters, maybe they haven't, you know, had a Republican or a Democrat in recent elections that they've really felt has spoken to them. What are the things about your platform that is resonating with them?
Well, there's a lot of things, but it's obviously the expansion of Medicare here in Kansas. We've got CanCare, which is a broken privatized system that, right now it doesn't cover nearly 200,000 Kansans that are stuck in the gap between what the CanCare covers and then what the ACA can pick up. And that has resonated across the board, because a lot of seniors are involved in that. We've also got some pretty hot topics here locally that local elected officials have been very diligent in making sure that people are protected. So corporate interests came in, wrote a bill, and then just shoved it through the Republican-controlled government here in Kansas, both sides, including the governor. And my opponent, of course, voted for that after telling a constituent that he wouldn't vote for it. Mm-hmm. And then last but not least, my opponent is the only dissenting vote in all of Kansas government to vote against agricultural hemp, which in a predominantly agricultural district, infuriated a lot of people.
Yeah, it certainly seems out of step. I want to learn a little bit more about your opponent. So Ronald Ellis is the incumbent. Who has he been as the incumbent? What role has he served there?
Well, that's just it. Nobody knows. and going out and door knocking thousands and thousands of doors, I have actually made personal contact with every single Democrat in the district, and I've gone through the unaffiliateds and now into the Republicans. Most people have no idea who he actually is, which is ironic because he's a 37-year retired teacher. He taught most of the people here, locally anyway, but as a legislator, nobody has ever heard from him.
Yeah. Well, it certainly seems like, I mean, based on the belief, you know, I don't want to encourage this necessarily, but people think that this election is going to be pretty bad for the Republicans. Being complacent in terms of your campaigning at this point seems like a pretty bad idea. As these polls have been showing that you're actually up, is there any indication that he is taking this threat more seriously?
Oh, no. He stepped right up to his game about 3 weeks ago. Okay. I've been involved in this campaign since February of last year, or about 2017, and nobody took me seriously. And I used that to my advantage. I just stayed under the radar and ran a very efficient campaign, kept it very cordial, and stuck to the just to the voting record and to the facts. But because of that, I think he didn't think that he could do anything and just sit back and ride the R into a re-election. And when it became apparent that wasn't going to happen, all of a sudden there's this influx of money, there's an influx of signs, and he's door knocking, but it's, you know, far too little too late. People already know who he is after me getting out for the last year.
Okay, well, we'll have to see if 1 month of campaigning is enough to go up against your 2 years of effort. And good luck to you in your upcoming election.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. I'll be watching for you on election night. With that, we are going to have to take a break. When we come back, Donald Trump has a new plan he is targeting, or at least he wants you to believe he's targeting birthright citizenship in the week leading up to the election. We'll be breaking down how that would actually work, what the argument supposedly is for it after this. Welcome back to the show, everyone. Just had an awesome interview with a great candidate in Kansas. A little bit later on the show, we're going to be joined by a congressional candidate in Indiana taking on the Pence family. So look forward to that in just a little bit. But first, I want to turn back to Trump for just a little bit. Donald Trump bristles again at the idea that he's responsible for any demonization of the media, despite the fact that he does that more than perhaps anything else as president. And that came up in last night's interview with Laura Ingraham. Here's what he said.
It's when I say enemy of the people, I'm talking about the fake news, and it is fake.
Which organizations?
And the thing is, my people understand. One quick story. So a reporter for the Washington Post does a story that a place that I was doing, an arena, was empty. And he shows a picture. Not a very good crowd, Mr. Trump, something to that effect. And then it turned out that he took the picture 5 hours before the people started coming into the arena. The arena was packed, and there were thousands of people outside. They had to retract it. But this is the kind of dishonesty that we have.
Okay, so that is a demonstration of, yes, perhaps a little bit of a petty story by some reporter. News that, I mean, did you see that? Was that the big story of the day? I don't even know what he's talking about. But also how petty he is. That whenever it is that this happened, if it was a month ago or a year ago or 3 years ago, he still thinks about it. And he thinks that that justifies calling the media the true enemy of the people. She tried there. It's not like Laura Ingraham has a lot of follow-up questions, but she did try there very briefly to ask which outlets, because he says it's not fair to say that he calls the media the enemy of the people. He just calls the fake news the enemy of the people and refuses now to actually say who that is. We know that he means the vast majority of the media, so it's a distinction without a difference. But the problem for him is that he did once actually define it. There is a tweet out there that you can find where he says what the fake news is, and it was CNN and the Washington Post and the New York Times. He listed literally the biggest media outlets on TV and in newspaper. That's the fake news. Okay. Well, at that point, I'm not really interested in whether you're talking about all of the media or just all of the biggest media outlets, the most critical, the most important. He does lump them all together, and it is consequential. We had the shooting at the Capitol Gazette. We had the CNN attempted bombing last week. There are other people out there that wear red hats and hate the media, and he is continuing to stoke that, as he has threatened to do in the wake of these acts of violence. So he doesn't like the criticism. Okay, that's fine. I don't like my life being threatened. And I think that my concern is a little bit more real, a little bit more important than yours at this point. And I really do feel for people at CNN that have to return to their office knowing that there are people out there that are frustrated that that bomb didn't go off. And they're very much in the sights. You know, people at the Washington Post also have to worry, not just about Trump. We're going to return to the story about Saudi Arabia a little bit later on. But the media is being targeted, continues to be demonized every night at Donald Trump's rallies, and he knows exactly what he's doing. With that said, I do want to turn to one of his proposals from today. Donald Trump is apparently setting his sights on birthright citizenship. It is this concept that if you are born in America, regardless of the legal status of your parents, you are a citizen. And that is derived from the Constitution. Now, he is not a fan of that. Many hardline far-right people in America don't like that either because they don't like the sort of people that become citizens through it. But there is a little bit of a problem that's standing in their way of actually overturning it. So we're going to get to that in just a little bit. But first, here is Donald Trump talking about how he thinks he can actually go about getting rid of birthright citizenship.
Some legal scholars believe you can get rid of birthright citizenship without changing the Constitution.
With an executive order.
Exactly.
Right.
Have you thought about that?
Yes.
Tell me more.
It was always told to me that you needed a constitutional amendment.
Right. 14th Amendment.
You don't. Number one, you don't need that. Number two,
I mean, that's in dispute.
You could definitely
that's very much in dispute.
Well, you can definitely do it with an act of Congress, but now they're saying I can do it just with an executive order. Now, how ridiculous. We're the only country in the world where a person comes in, has a baby, and the baby is essentially a citizen of the United States for 85 years with all of those benefits. It's ridiculous, and it has to end.
Have you talked about that with counsel?
Yeah. I have.
So we're in the process.
It's in the process. It'll happen. With an executive order. That's what you're talking about, right?
Yeah,
that's
exactly
a very interesting
question.
I didn't think anybody but knew that but me. I thought I was the only one. Jonathan,
I've got
impressed.
A good guess.
I'm impressed.
Yeah, that was absolutely pathetic and also dangerous. So first of all, the idea that we're the only country in the world that has birthright citizenship is not technically true. We are the only country in the United States that has birthright citizenship. But we are actually, we have a few neighbors that do it. So Canada and Mexico and Cuba and Venezuela and basically every single country in our hemisphere has some version of birthright citizenship. So that is an obvious lie that you can only tell if you assume that the people that you want to hear it don't care about the actual truth. Virtually every single country has birthright citizenship in our hemisphere, and especially Mexico, who he loves to say is sort of abusing this, getting rid of people, sending them here to become citizens. They too allow people to get a version of citizenship through this exact process. So he says casually there, number one, you don't need an amendment. You can just do it through an act of Congress, or you can just do it through an executive order. That is, as the reporter pointed out, very much in dispute. But it's not in dispute the way that, like, you know, what's the best cheese is in dispute. It's legally, in terms of the Supreme Court, very much in dispute because the Constitution is not really ambiguous on this issue. The section of the Constitution that has given us birthright citizenship reads like this. All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. All persons born. That is very, 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 very clear. These people are born here. And so they become citizens. Now, for a long time, sort of the fringe opinion was, well, if you bring that back up, it says all people born, sure, but it also says under the jurisdiction of. And that's where they think they have a point. They think that they can make the case that those people are not under the jurisdiction because they're not US residents. Well, there's a fun little thought experiment that you can do to make clear how ridiculous this is. So they're saying you don't become a citizen because you're not under the jurisdiction. So you don't actually, you're not, like, US law doesn't matter to you because you're not, you know, like, you can't get those rights. Is there any other example where that makes sense? So if that is the case, if you come in from Mexico and you run someone over with your car and the police try to stop you, just keep on driving. You're not under US jurisdiction, okay? If you want to rob someone, if you want to murder someone, these far-right thinkers are saying you don't have to abide by US law. That is obviously ridiculous. It would not apply to anything other than their idea of how to get rid of birthright citizenship. And to make it even more obvious how ridiculous that is, the idea that we just assume, obviously, that every citizen is under the jurisdiction, but non-citizens are not, is made ridiculous by the fact that foreign diplomats are specifically granted exemption from US jurisdiction on most laws. So we understand that you can make those distinctions, and we make it in that case. We did not make it in the case of the kids that are brought in and are, or I should say, are born here, because at the time it was obvious that they were intended to be citizens. That has never been seriously challenged in the Supreme Court. They are hoping that now that they've made a very strong conservative majority in the Supreme Court, that they can actually do that. But that is very much an extreme position. And by the way, you might be watching this and think, well, I don't really care about birthright citizenship. It's not an issue that I care about. I don't really care about immigration that much either. What he just demonstrated in that video is more dangerous and goes far beyond just birthright citizenship. Because the concern here is that he is going to attempt to do, with a stroke of his pen, is basically write an amendment to the Constitution. And if he feels he can do that, and the only justification he needs is to say, first thing I can do it, then where does that actually stop? What else can he do to change the Constitution? If he wants to write an executive order, and if the Republicans that control the Senate and the House don't have a problem with it, the Constitution no longer means anything. The Supreme Court, effectively, in their job as overseer of the Constitution and constitutionality, mean nothing. We effectively have a king in America. And I don't think that we're going to get to that point. I think that we're going to stop this, and I think to some extent it's a bit of an election ploy. But Donald Trump just made clear there that he thinks that he has utter control over the text of the Constitution going forward. And that seems like kind of a big deal. Okay, we are going to take a break. When we come back, another candidate's going to join us. We'll see you in just a few. Down in Indiana, Mike Pence's brother Greg is jumping into politics, attempting to become the congressman in Indiana's 6th district. Standing in his way is Janine Lee Lake, who joins us now on the Damage Report. Janine, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, John. I'm glad to be here today.
We're glad to have you. So I want to start off. People are much more familiar with Mike Pence. How does Greg compare? Is he a better or worse Pence?
Well, I think he said there's no daylight between myself and that, my views, and that of my brother's views, and that of Donald Trump's views. So, you know, I'll let people take it from there.
Okay, well, now I'm scared. So thank you for that. So I want to talk about your candidacy. So I read that your background is actually in reporting. So first of all, I want to make sure that that's the case. But if it is, how does that influence your campaigning now that you've moved over to the political side?
Well, yes, I've been a newspaper reporter for 30 years. I got my degree from Ball State University, and I've worked with a variety of newspapers all over the country, everywhere from Muncie and the Star Press to USA Today with Gannett. And now I own my own newspaper. It's called The Good News, and it's a bi-monthly newspaper that looks at coverage of minorities and also people of faith.
Okay, well, that sounds very positive. I do want to ask you, with sort of the anti-media atmosphere that we've had in our country now for a couple of years that you're running now, what do you think about the fact that it seems like many politicians are starting to use negative sentiment towards the media to mobilize their voters? What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's really sad where we're at now with regards to the president of the United States on a continual basis attacking the media. Mm-hmm. As a 30-year journalist, I've been a person that I pride myself, on providing objective news, true and accurate news, as is the case of most every journalist I've ever met along three lines, along 30 years. A long time ago, there used to be a little moniker that said, if your mother tells you that she loves you, go and get three sources. And we always took that very seriously. So to be continuously degraded and, insulted as if we are not clear-thinking adults that know the difference between the truth and a lie is extremely insulting to me, not only as a citizen, but as a newspaper reporter, as a journalist that really cares about my profession. And, as a member of the Fourth Estate, I've been very proud, and I still am very proud to be a reporter.
Yeah. So you're in a state that previously has been quite Republican, supportive of Donald Trump previously. Now you're out there making the case with, I would say, a platform that's very different from his in terms of some important issues, especially your approach to what should happen with healthcare in America and Indiana specifically. So as you're making that case, I'm always curious, what are people like getting fired up about going into this election?
Well, healthcare is the number one thing that I've seen, and it affects so many different areas. We just spent an evening last night in Scott County, where they're having a terrible opioid epidemic at this point. They've also had just a season where they've dealt with HIV, crisis down there, as well as Hep C. You know, these are people that need Medicare for all. We are a proponent of that. We've been saying that since the very beginning of this campaign. That tackles mental health care issues, which a lot of people are self-medicating with these opioids.
Yeah.
That handles just a variety of different things. That's what I'm hearing more than anything on the campaign trail right now. And people are excited to be able to, hear a candidate that is actually willing to talk about the issues. One of the issues of my campaign is that I'm actually running against a phantom candidate. He does have this name as Pence, but you know, he is unwilling to debate me. I've been running for 16 months. I've rarely seen him at any events. I hear that he's at events that have a wealthy donors, I guess a $25,000 plate and that kind of thing. But you know, yeah. So he's really hard. It's kind of hard to run against a person that you really don't know their views. Quite honestly, the only thing I can go by is, you know, what the president said and what the terrible RFRA kind of legislation that his younger brother Mike Pence tried to slam into Indiana a few years ago.
Well, if he's saying that he's very similar to his Mike Pence, to his brother, I think that we have a good idea of what he actually stands for, and hopefully people will look into your positions on the issues, your proposals, and see that there's a gigantic distinction there, whether he wants to debate you or not.
Well, thank you. I hope so, because I'm definitely the very antithesis of the Trump Pence agenda, Greg Pence, and all of the I believe that those cruel type of policies and legislation that they stand for. This administration, in my opinion, they herald themselves, at least the vice president does, as a person of faith. But I'm here to tell you, John, those kind of policies and things that they're implementing now, separating children from their mother's arms, the attacks on not only the media, but attacks on women, some of the insulting ways they have degraded. I believe the prettier part of the population, whether it's calling them dogs, fat, pigs, horse face, whatever it is, you know, the things that are coming out of the Oval Office, you know, those are words that really have an impact on our children and how we perceive one another. And I'm wanting to bring in more civility into Washington, D.C. and Congress.
Well, and hopefully in just 7 days, you'll be able to do that. Janine Lee Lake, thank you for joining us on the Damage Report.
Thank you very much, John. It was great to be here.
Thank you. Have a good day. We're going to have one more break. When we come back, I want to take you on a little tour around the world, some stuff going on that's not necessarily making headlines that perhaps should after this. Here in America, we're dealing with the aftermath of a week of political violence and obviously very invested with what's going to happen in the midterms. But meanwhile in nature. I was really interested to find out which animal Brett was going to choose for that. So meanwhile in nature, we're running out of animals. Humanity has wiped out 60% of mammals, birds, fish, and reptiles since 1970, leading the world's foremost experts to warn that the annihilation of wildlife is now an emergency that threatens civilization itself. And if it seems weird that a story like 60% of all of the animals in the world going away over the course of one person's lifetime, if it seems like that should be covered more, I am right there with you. So we have a quote, by the way, from Executive Director of Science and Conservation at the World Wildlife Fund that says, "We are sleepwalking towards the edge of a cliff. If there was a 60% decline in the human population, that would be the equivalent of emptying North America, South America, Africa, Europe, China, and Oceania. That is the scale of what we have done." And I want to propose sort of a hypothetical. What if we said we wanted to kill 60% of all of the animals in the world? You'd probably say that's impossible. How could we possibly do that? But we have found a way. And the way that we have found is by continuing to expand our population, moving into areas that used to be wildlife and, you know, forest and all of that, burning down these areas, affecting the climate, affecting pollution levels, and basically making the world inhospitable to a number of species that have previously thrived for literally hundreds of millions, if not billions, of years. That is what we have been able to achieve as a species. And we have done it while no one is even acknowledging that we're doing this. If I had started this story saying that we've wiped out 10%, you'd probably be a little bit scared. But it is far, far worse than that. And the numbers in some particular areas are even worse. Freshwater habitats have collapsed around the world by 83%. South and Central American populations of animals have declined by 89%. They are literally running out of animals in significant chunks of the world, and we're acting like nothing is happening. So that's what's happening in nature. Meanwhile, in China. China's having some issues with animals as well. They're now legalizing the use of certain animal parts that had previously been illegal. The Chinese government has legalized the use of endangered tiger and rhino products for medical purposes, a move wildlife activists say will be a setback to efforts to protect the increasingly endangered animals. And so specifically here, to be fair, it is only farmed animals, because there is actually an industry that farms rhinos and tigers, thousands of them, to harvest body parts for dubious cures for a variety of illnesses that you'll be shocked to find out don't actually work. In 2010, the World Federation of Chinese Medicine Societies issued a statement saying there was no evidence for the claimed medical benefits of tiger bone. No proof of medical benefits from rhino horn have been found either. But that has not stopped a trade in it from continuing even when it was illegal. And now that it has been legalized, it is likely to become even more common, even though these animals around the world have become rarer and rarer. If you can actually get an industry going that is able to breed them, I think there are more productive uses for those animals, like letting them live, especially as animals around the world are going away. So that is what's happening in China. Meanwhile, in Nepal. Wow, that is a beautiful country. Nepal's having issues of their own, and the solution that they've come up for with dealing with that is banning pornography, something we occasionally talk about here in the US as well. So this has to do with sexual assault, which is becoming much more common. In the past 5 years in Nepal, sexual assault rates have gone up by 60%. And this is their solution. They've banned porn and added harsh fines or prison sentences for internet service providers who refuse to comply. Now, if it seems to you like that is not actually a solution to the problem, especially considering the fact that the vast majority of sexual assaults aren't really about sex at all, they're about power and they are violent crimes, you're probably right. Critics of the ban question whether there was any link between pornography and Nepal's sexual assault numbers, and if it was even possible to prevent people from accessing the websites with the provision of firewall evading software. And by the way, in recent history, this hasn't worked in the past. Nepal actually had a sort of softer ban on pornography just a few years ago, and eventually the government stopped enforcing it because they found that it was in fact unenforceable. And along the way, rates of sexual assault have continued to go up. So probably not a solution. I would look at some more cultural factors, you know, toxic masculinity, things like that, that are leading to these sorts of rises, not just in Nepal, but in a number of countries around the world. So that is what's going on in Nepal. Meanwhile, in Turkey. Did you know that a journalist was killed in Turkey? I know that we reported on it a lot, but everybody seems to have forgotten it for some reason, which seems bizarre to me considering it was one of the main stories like a week and a half ago. Jamal Khashoggi was murdered and dismembered in Turkey by a team of assassins sent from the Saudi government. I'm not saying this because it's news. I'm saying this because how is this not news still? Like, yes, we have serious problems. There was the synagogue shooting. The midterms are coming up. We've had all those bombs and everything. But this guy was killed and our country has still done absolutely nothing. Jamal was a Washington Post reporter. He was a US resident. He was one of us. Certainly, we should care regardless whether he'd been a Turkish citizen or a Saudi citizen or whoever. But he was one of our reporters, and he was brutally murdered in Turkey just a couple of weeks ago, and our government does not give a damn. There have been no consequences whatsoever. The arms deals continue to go forward for Saudi Arabia. We are still assisting them in their war in Yemen, regardless of the human and moral cost there. And we have simply moved on, not just as a society, but even the media that should be more attentive to issues like this. Yes, we have to pay attention to all of the news going on around America and around the world. That's why we're doing this segment. But we cannot forget about big stories like this just because shiny new objects come up. Jamal Khashoggi was brutally murdered. There needs to be consequences. Now, with that said, thank you for watching us. Tomorrow, we're going to have JR, huge guest coming up in the near future. So you're going to want to stay tuned. Thank you for watching, and we'll see you tomorrow morning. Thank you for listening to the Damage Report podcast, the show covering the true threats facing our country and what you can actually do about them. You can support this free podcast by leaving us a review and giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to be listening to it. Every review helps more people discover the show at no cost to you. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.